Here are just some of the pressing issues of the day. Marriage equality, so-called traditional family values, the rights of transgendered people, sexual liberation, gender parity. Sound familiar? Well, today's headlines could be ripped right from the pages of a 30-year-old newspaper.
L'Cage aux Folles emerged on the cultural scene as a play, a rollicking farce by French playwright Jean Poiret in 1973. Just a few years later, the film L'Cage, directed by Edward Molinaro, became one of the most successful French films of all time and among the top-grossing foreign films in America.
And then finally, with a book by Harvey Fierstein and music by the legendary Jerry Herman, L'Cage aux Folles became a hit musical on Broadway. The notions of dignity and equality for all were etched for good in the global consciousness with timeless anthems such as The Best of Times Is Now and, of course, I Am What I Am. And what I am is Julian Fleischer.
And I'm Thomas Z. Shepard.
And Thomas, what you are is legendary producer of the original Broadway cast recording of this remarkable show. And together, we are your hosts for today's For the Record, L'Cage aux Folles. Thomas, what did you know about L'Cage aux Folles before you went into the studio to record the original cast recording?
Well, I had seen the film quite some time before that. What I knew basically was what I learned out of town, because I followed the show, particularly in Boston. As a matter of fact, it might have been only in Boston. And I spent some time there, you know, with Jerry Herman, with Arthur Lawrence, with Harvey Fierstein, so that I had more than a nodding acquaintance with both the show and the people who wrote it.
And this is in your capacity as a producer at RCA, am I right?
That's exactly right.
So your job at this time is to keep your eye on shows, get a sense of what's coming down through the pipeline, what's a hit on Broadway, am I right?
Yes, I was vice president of Red Seal and Classical, which means I was in charge of the Classical and Broadway divisions.
Let's talk a little bit about the story of L'Cage aux Folles, what happens to the characters, and how these songs help tell their story. We open in a drag club on the French Riviera, am I correct?
Yes, you're correct.
And the star of the cabaret goes by the name Zsa Zsa.
That's right.
And she is partnered with the gentleman who runs the cabaret, manages it, and serves as the MC.
Georges, actually, played by Jean Barry. And as I recall, the structure of the plot is such that his young son, who was the result of a one-night stand that George had with a woman, is engaged, and he wants to bring his fiancée to meet George and Zsa Zsa. And he's got a couple of problems with that, because they're not exactly a typical couple. So the rest of the show is really revolves around how these two gay men manage to at least attempt to pull off a great con job and make it look like they are a happily married heterosexual couple.
And they need to do this because the parents of the fiancé are a super right-wing political couple who object on strict so-called moral grounds to the notion of homosexuality and drag and the kind of things that go on in your average nightclub on the French Riviera.
What Georges tries to do is to get Zsa Zsa to act far more masculine so that they can pass themselves off as two straight men to the girl's parents.
And comedy ensues. Was the show that you saw in Boston as funny as what ended up on Broadway?
Jerry Herman had written a piece for the girl's father. What is he? Was he a congressman, a senator? A
political figure.
Exactly.
Who has to pander to his base.
Yes, and this was the most pandering song you can imagine, because he said he hated everybody, and he named every minority and every sexual preference that ever existed. And it was terribly funny.
It also sounds terribly contemporary.
It was terribly contemporary. You're right. And when the show was trying out in New York, the song wasn't there. Jerry, and perhaps Arthur too, but they felt that this was such a basically wholesome family show that this put an edginess, an edge to the show that they felt somehow did not run parallel to the basic emotional thread of the show.
That takes a lot of maturity, does it not?
Yes, it does. That explains why I liked it so much and why they cut it.
Well, I mean, I know it's difficult for a composer who's written a very great comic number to cut it out of a show. I mean, a good comic number is not easy to write. So when you've achieved it, it can be very painful to let it go. But obviously, they made the right decision because the show became a global hit.
Except for that one song being omitted, the show that played in Boston was exactly the show that played in New York during its first 3 weeks of previews.
And the show famously opens with a view of the performers who inhabit La Cage Folle, which is a cabaret on the French Riviera.
Yes, on the stage there are a whole bunch of guys and one girl.
But they all appear as women.
That's right.
This is all a bunch of dudes dressed as showgirls, and that's the beauty, the wonder, and the spectacle of this particular cabaret. And the song that they sing together is
We Are What We Are. And then George Hearn later transmogrifies it into I Am What I Am, turning it into an anthem for a proud gay man.
Let's not wait. Let's listen to the fabulous opening number that you, Tom Shepard, produced the recording of from La Cage aux Folles by Jerry Herman. This is We Are What We Are.
Bonsoir, bonsoir. Here we are at the pride of Saint-Tropez, the envy of the cabaret world, the jewel of the Riviera. Only champagne from now to the finale. Monsieur Dunn, I beg you, open your eyes. You have arrived at La Cage aux Folles.
That is an opening number for the ages. That's We Are What We Are from La Cage aux Folles. I'll tell you, nobody knows how to take a hook and repeat it like Jerry Herman. I mean, this is a 32-bar song, right?
That's right.
Just the simplest possible tune, but it's so infectious.
Yes.
You can imagine what it must have been like to be in the audience and just feel the excitement and the thrill rush through the house.
If the recording made you feel that you were in the house, then the recording succeeded. Because, in fact, it's a bunch of people in a windowless room standing in front of microphones.
Right.
And from that, one tries to create the illusion that it's an entire theatrical experience.
You're always sort of painting an oral picture.
Exactly.
So this cast album was unusual in that it was recorded before the show opened on Broadway.
Well, the show was, as they say in the business, the show was frozen. And they guaranteed this to us at RCA. Jerry said, if you record it before we open, we promise you this is the same show. And so we did. We recorded it probably about 10 days before the show opened, which gave me time to carefully edit and mix it.
So this album, in all of its vinyl glory, was available to audiences opening night, August 21st, 1983, at the Palace Theater in New York City.
Exactly.
That was rare.
Very rare. As a matter of fact, in my entire recording experience, this has never happened before or since.
Wow.
I don't know of any other case where that happened.
I have no reason not to believe you. And even if there is an exception to the rule, who cares? Now, in the musical theater, there are often types of songs. There's the I Am song, the I Want song. These are all sort of templates that musical theater writers use.
Yes.
So soon after we hear We Are What We Are, which we just listened to, we get to the first classic I Am number, A Little More Mascara.
Yes, and you learn about Zsa Zsa as George Hearn tells you how he's applying his makeup to turn from a man into a drag queen.
Once again, I'm a little depressed by the tired old face that I see. Once again, it is time to be someone who's anyone other than me. With a rare combination of girlish excitement and manly restraint, I position my precious assortment of pencils and powders and paint. So whenever I feel that my place in the world is beginning to crash, I apply one great stroke of mascara to my rather limp upper lash. And I can cope again. Good God, there's hope again. When life is a real bitch again, and my old sense of humor has up and gone, it's time for the big switch again. I put a little more mascara on. When I count my crow's feet again and tire of this perpetual marathon, I put down the John seat again and put a little.
When Al Ban is tucked away and Zsa Zsa is here.
When everything slides down the old tubes again and when my self-esteem has begun to drift, I strap on my fake boobs again and literally give myself a lift. So when it's cold and when it's bleak, I simply rouge the other cheek, for I can face another day in slipper satin lingerie to make depression disappear. I screw some rhinestones on my ear and put my brooches and tiara and a little more mascara on. Ankle straps, narrow boob,
put a little more mascara on, sung by George Hearn, who is remarkable in this part.
Isn't he?
It's career-making.
Yes.
Extraordinary. You know, it actually reminds me also of a song that came, I don't know, 25 years later in John Cameron Mitchell and Stephen Trask's drag musical Hedwig and the Angry Inch called Wig in a Box, which is a very similar tune. A person getting into drag, talking about the power of makeup and the power to transform yourself into something more beautiful than what you feel you are without it.
Yes, for Al Ban, his life really only takes shape, at least his professional life, when he's fully made up and costumed. That's when he comes alive, and that comes through so beautifully in the way George performs it. You can hear his energy level and his enthusiasm as the song goes along. The song had a snare drum just playing time, basically, throughout the whole song. And even though the song is full of percussion, a lot of xylophone bells, things like that, something about the snare drum made it sound insincere. to me. I felt like I was listening to a routine. It was nightclubby, but in the wrong sense of the word, because Al Bass sings this number not on stage. He sings it in his dressing room. And so what you hear on this recording is snareless, but it has an awful lot of other, I think, rather interesting sounds.
The snareless recording. Did you record the snare and take it out or just not record it?
I didn't record it. I didn't have 100% isolation on the drum kit. It was mic'd and it was enclosed to some degree. It wasn't 100% enclosed, which means had it played, I could have reduced it by taking out its track, but there still would have been leakage into some of the other microphones.
And they kept the snare in the show.
Oh, sure. I don't think anything I did had any effect on the show.
But it is a really interesting point because I can imagine with a snare, it might sound a little exterior, whereas this is sort of an interior monologue in a way.
I prefer to think that Albin was making this up as he went along, not that he was giving me his routine. It's the best I can do to explain it. It's totally subjective, and it may be quite meaningless in the end. But it was important to me at the time.
Well, it certainly makes sense, and you do. I mean, the song is very enjoyable, and it has a kind of poignance and a personal quality that makes it very believable. And it's doing what a classic I Am song, as they call it in the musical theater, is supposed to do, which is give you an insight into who this person is or who they think they are, a point which the show continues to make in the song Masculinity, also in quotes, in which Georges tries to instruct Albin / Zsa Zsa in the fine art of acting like a man.
There's a lot to perhaps object to in this song, because what it really is saying, that the only way to be acceptable is if you act in a traditional manly fashion. And it's not too hard for Georges to do, because Georges does not act in any way traditionally gay, as it were, whereas Albin is almost a parody of femininity. And so for Georges to try and get Albin to get rid of these feminine habits is quite a chore. But he's not very successful.
Here it is. This is Masculinity from La Cage aux Folles.
I want you to pick up that piece of toast like a man. Think of this as masculine toast and masculine butter, ready for spreading by a masculine hand. Pick up that knife and make believe it's a machete. It'll take all your strength and steady nerves for hacking your way through the cherry preserves. Think of John Wayne and Jean-Paul Belmondo. Think of the Legionnaires and Charlemagne's men. So like a stevedore, you grab your cup, and if God forbid that your pinky pops up, you can climb back up the mountain once again. Listen to that. Whoop! About that voice of yours. Grunt like an ape and growl like a tiger. Give us a roaring, snoring, masculine laugh. Try to remember that John Wayne was not soprano. Try making it rough and gruff and low. Try more of John Wayne and less Bridget Bardot. Think of Dingo and think of Rasputin.
Think like a Daniel marching into the den.
While trying to join the burly brute, if you forget that your nylons are under your boots.
Thinking is calling, acting are as vocal.
Think
of Achilles, Hunt, and Robin
Hood.
Try not to weaken or collapse. If they discover the pantyhose under your tax, you can climb back up, 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 and up again.
Masculinity from La Cage aux Folles, recorded by my friend Tom Shepard, here with me in the studio. This is For the Record, La Cage aux Folles. Part of what's so remarkable about this show, if I may say, is what you referred to earlier, I think, as its gentleness, a kind of light touch, in that it manages to skewer everybody. Not just the characters, but the world that's observing these characters. You know, they understand that they're being watched, and they understand that the world expects them to behave a certain way. And so it has a remarkable way of skewering both sides of that equation.
It does. Also, these characters, by and large, are very lovable.
Right.
You can't help but like them through the course of this show.
Which is, I think, remarkable, especially because, let's face it, the play came of age in the 70s, the movie right afterwards, and this show opened in the early 80s. And I think we know that part of what the hostility towards gay people has traditionally been has had to do with the hoary notion that femininity and gayness go hand in hand, and that somehow that's the danger. And so to make a musical comedy about a very effeminate gay man in which that effeminacy is not presented as a problem, I think is really a tough job, and they pull it off.
They pull it off. Also, these two men are very devoted to their craft, very devoted to one another, and in an age when same-sex marriage didn't exist, these two men were, in fact, tantamount to being married. They existed only for each other.
And that devotion and the richness of their interchange comes across vividly and makes it extremely difficult not to love them.
That's right.
But for those folks who are not convinced, Act One of La Cage aux Folles closes with one of the great Act One closing numbers, I think, in the history of musical theater, I Am What I Am.
Which, very cleverly, Jerry Herman builds on the same tune that he opened the show with when the chorus of boys and girls sing We Are What We Are. Jerry takes that production number in a theater and transmogrifies it, turns it into a personal statement, a personal, what's the word, validation, almost an explosion of pride, and it's a fantastic song.
When I'm down, when I'm in the dumps, and I need a lift, I put this track on. I have been listening to your recording of this song for as long as I can remember, and not just pursuant to its sexual politics, but just in general, and its uplift, its sense of purpose, of life-affirming agency that I don't know any other number, really, that does what this song does and does it this way. So it's with great thanks to you, Tom, for having put George Hearn's remarkable performance of this beautiful song on wax. Please join me now for the Act One closing number of La Cage aux Folles, a song that surely will get you back in the theater after intermission. I Am What I Am.
I am what I am. I am my own special creation. So come take a look, give me the hook or the ovation. It's my world that I want to have a little pride in. My world, and it's not a place I have to hide in. Life's not worth a damn till you can say, hey world, I am what I am. I am what I am. I don't want praise. I don't want pity. I bang my own drum. Some think it's noise. I think it's pretty. And so what if I love each feather and each spangle? Different angle. Your life is a sham till you can shout out loud, I am what I am. It's not worth a damn till you can say, hey world, I am what I am. Thank you.
That is how you close the first act, ladies and gentlemen. George Hearn's remarkable performance of I Am What I Am. And what I am is Julian Fleischer, joined today in the studio with the great Tom Shepard, the masterful record producer who made that recording.
Hi, Julian.
I Am What I Am, which is, as you know, one of my favorite tracks of all time from any record ever for any reason, and I'm honored to be able to sit here and tell you that in person. But one of the things that makes the performance so remarkable and so powerful is that at the very end of the number, as it's really reaching its climax, the character that Hearn is playing rips off his wig and stands there sort of fully exposed as the man that he is when he says, I am what I am.
It's interesting you bring that up, because when George was asked to perform this at one of the Hollywood Awards, it might have been the Academy Awards, he insisted that if he did it, he would not do it in costume. And of course, everybody wanted him to do it in costume for the reasons you just said, because it's such a wonderful, spectacular moment when the wig comes off. But George felt that he was enough of an actor that he could make it work on his own terms. As a matter of fact, what he said about it was, I am what I am, and who I am is wearing a tux.
Well, I dare say he's right, because when I went looking for this on YouTube, the only performance of him that I could find is at a tribute to Jerry Herman at the Hollywood Bowl in front of an enormous orchestra, and he is standing there in a tux, and it's just as remarkable. And it's a tribute to the song as well as to the performer, because it doesn't actually need that moment from the story to send its message all the way to the back of the house.
Well, maybe it's also a tribute to Jerry Herman, because he wrote a terrific song.
Well, this song became a global anthem for gay rights, and I'm wondering what the feeling was like in the room when you were making this album, particularly because the creative team behind it were all gay men. What was it like?
Well, what they had in common, in addition to being gay, was that they were extraordinarily talented. Right after that, I think what they had in common ends, because Jerry, although he's very sunny, he's very, very professional. He's very concentrated. He's very enthusiastic. And you feel like he's a team player. He's making the recording with you. Harvey, if you've ever met or worked with Harvey, is ebullient.
Before we turned on the microphones today, you gifted us with a pretty convincing impersonation of Harvey Fierstein. Can I hear it?
Well, I'll see if I can do it again, but I'm not quite sure.
That's actually uncanny. I like it.
I've always been good at this sort of thing.
And he... And he's very, very good-humored and full of energy and far more extrovertish than Jerry. But they're both good-humored guys. Not ice cream good-humored. Not, but we'll take that. They're both good-humored guys. Arthur Lawrence was not a good-humored guy. He was very, very difficult. He could be very tactless. I have actually seen him be self-destructive when I was on a panel with him once when we were evaluating some material that some songwriters from ASCAP were auditioning. So Arthur's just not very nice.
You're not alone in asserting this, I might add. Was he ever mean to you?
Yes, he was mean to me. But, you know, the world, you just got to keep going in this world. I had it in my agreement with RCA that the last name that appeared on the jacket was my name, and the credit was always produced for records by Thomas E. Shepard. And I was very happy with that. It was very nice being last. As far as I was concerned, it was as good as being first.
Mm-hmm.
Arthur, however, Arthur wanted to be last. He said that he would not let my name be below his. So the Solomonic decision was made, I believe, by Bob Sommer, our president, who said, well, supposing we move Tom's name over to one side, so he'll have a place all his own, and you, Arthur, will still be the last in the final credits. Arthur agreed. I agreed. Actually, I wasn't terribly unhappy about it, but I didn't like being forced into it. You know, it would have been nice if Arthur said, you know, look, Tom, I've always been there, and, you know, do me a favor. But Arthur didn't work that way. Arthur worked through attorneys, through agents, and so I found out that way that my name was being moved to a different spot. No big deal, but that was Arthur.
Well, from all the stories I've heard over the years, that one doesn't surprise me at all. We just heard I Am What I Am, and it's an example, I think, of what Jerry Herman does perhaps better than any other Broadway songwriter, which is to take a very sort of simple tune and turn it into something that is just greater than the sum of its parts. But what a lot of people don't know is that he was capable of some very sophisticated songwriting.
You know, there's a tradition, particularly in opera, where the four or five or six principal characters each express their own point of view simultaneously, as it were, to the audience, secure in the knowledge that the person standing on stage on either side of them can't hear them at all. And if you accept that conceit, then you can really have a very good time with this very unusual number, a collection of individual statements made by each of the principals, by the ambassador, by the ambassador's wife, by Georges, by his son, by the servant who's in the household. And they're all singing their own special little asides, as it were. And then it all gets put together, and that's what counterpoint is, when you take several melodies and you play them simultaneously. Anyone who cares to believe that Jerry Herman was not, in fact, a rather sophisticated composer needs only to listen to this to see what a terrific job he could do.
So this is a formal dinner where the people are all sort of realizing that things are not exactly what they appear to be.
They're all uncomfortable.
But really, it lends itself to comedy.
It does indeed. It also lends itself to recording. It's so much easier on a recording to differentiate between, let's say, the right side, between right and center, center, between left and center, left. You can make these delineations very, very clear on a recording. You'll never hear them sound quite that clear in a theater because the theater, they mic everything and it comes out monaural generally from a bunch of loudspeakers. So to get the real sense of directionality and interplay, I think in many ways the recording is the best way to experience it.
I'm Julian Fleischer.
I'm Tom Shepard.
This is For the Record, La Caja Folle, and we are about to listen to your recording of Cocktail Counterpoint from Act Two of La Caja Folle.
I joined the Foreign Legion with a saber in my hand and crawled across the desert with my belly in the sand.
Oh, dishes, they're so delicate and frail. Mine have naked children, I believe their own.
This is even worse than I feared. The son is strange, the father is
weird. This is for you, Papa.
I joined the Foreign Legion with a saber in my hand and stole across the desert with my belly.
Our new windows are
with men of their cattle and their
shades of blue
and
trees of red.
If you're just joining us, this is For the Record, La Caja Folle. I am Julian Fleischer.
I'm Tom Shepard.
And we just listened to Cocktail Counterpoint from Tom's recording of the original cast album of La Caja Folle, an example of remarkable counterpoint from the great Jerry Herman. Herman, as you point out, always liked to have one signature song in every show.
That's absolutely so. I mean, I think the quintessential example is Hello, Dolly, which had many lives of its own, from Barbra Streisand to Louis Armstrong. In the case of this show, whereas I Am What I Am is perhaps the anthem of the show, the 11 o'clock number, The Best of Times, is really the one that people carry out of the theater with them. It's sung very near the end of the show. Its messages are universal. They don't relate necessarily to any action that took place on stage. And as a result, the song was able to become rather an anthem, a kind of Auld Lang Syne, if you will, you know, which people could sing to celebrate happy occasions, weddings, bar mitzvahs, whatever.
Indeed, I actually just finished producing a record for a young singer here in New York by the name of Molly Pope. She finishes her concert that we recorded live here in New York with this song, and we passed out a lyric sheet so the audience could sing along, but wouldn't you know it, they didn't need that sheet.
The best of times is now. What's left of summer but a faded rose? The best of times is now. As for tomorrow, well, who knows? Who knows? Who knows? So hold this moment fast and live and love as hard as you know how, and make this moment last, because the best of times is now, is now, is now.
That was The Best of Times Is Now, a classic anthem affirming the joy of being alive by the great Jerry Herman, and it announces the last chapter in the story of La Cage aux Folles.
Yes, because La Cage aux Folles, the club itself, is about to be raided by the police.
And that's bad news for the Dantons, the future parents-in-law of young Jean-Michel, because they are famously anti-gay.
Yes, and it turns out that the only way they can get out of that club alive and unnoticed is if they wear the same apparel as the people in the club. In other words, they have to all go in drag.
So George and Albin, they convince the Dandons to do this by bargaining. They say, if you will let our kids get married, we'll get you out of here without having the paparazzi see you.
And but we see them, and it's hysterical, and it makes a great ending for the show.
And here is the finale from La Cage aux Folles.
Once again, my friends, the inevitable is upon us. It is time for us to end our little show, for all the pieces that have flown apart to come together. Monsieur Dan,
celebration with you on my arm. Walking's a new sensation with you on my arm. Each time I face a morning that's boring and bland, with you it looks good, with you it looks great, with you it looks grand. And I
The Finale from La Caja Foll, produced for Records by Thomas Z. Shepard, my co-host on For the Record.
It's been a pleasure being here with you, Julian.
Always a pleasure to be with you here, Tom. And it's interesting you mentioned that this was the first time a Broadway cast recording was available by opening night.
As far as I know, yes, that's
true. Well, the first one in your experience,
anyway. Absolutely.
Great. Well, it seems to have been a good strategic move because I'm certain that as people left the theater, they just grabbed up that recording, the music being so catchy, so much fun, and also full of important and meaningful messages.
Yep, it was a great evening in every way. The show was great and people bought a lot of records.
One of which at some point got into my hands more years ago than I can recall, and I've enjoyed ever since. So thank you again, Tom, and your team at RCA.
And thank you, Julian. It's been a pleasure sharing this with you today.
For the Record is a production of WNYC, WQXR, and the Jonathan Channel. The show is produced by Ellie Smerling, and our executive producer is Mr. Michael Shoeb, and I am what I am, and what I am is Julian Fleischer.
And I'm Tom Shepard.
Bye now.
Goodbye.